Good evening, everybody. Welcome to this ordinary general meeting. Copies of the minutes of the ordinary general meeting held on 23rd of January have been displayed on the Institute notice board and will be taken as read. May I sign them as a correct record, please? I'd like to extend a particular welcome to two official guests here this evening. Denis Autier, Head of Global Risk Solutions at BNP Paribas, and Arnaud Marais, Head of Policy at the UK Debt Management Office. You're both most welcome. And I'd also like to welcome any personal guests of members. We have a paper tonight entitled Living with Mortality, Longevity Bonds and Other Mortality-Linked Securities. And I'd like to, in a moment, invite David Blake, one of the authors, to introduce the paper. Unfortunately, we have two of the authors here tonight, David Blake and Andrew Cairns. Unfortunately, Kevin Dowd, the third author, is unwell and not able to be with us tonight. So, David, may I invite you to introduce the paper?
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. It's fallen on me to introduce our paper this evening, Living with Mortality, Longevity Bonds and Other Mortality-Linked Securities. This paper should be read as partly a summary of where we are in terms of a possible market for these instruments and also suggestions and ideas about how we might look forward and progress. So longevity risk is the risk that aggregate survival rates are higher than anticipated. This is now a risk that is regarded as a key factor for life assurers and pension funds and indeed the state providing state pension plans. And it's so a problem looking for a solution. And we are questioning and wondering whether the capital markets can provide such a solution to the problem. Here is a table, not in the paper, but from the recent report of the Pensions Commission, the Turner Report, which shows you his estimates of the extent of longevity risk in the UK economy and where it lies, and also how little of it lies in the hands of those who are supposed to be experts in managing it, namely the insurance companies. Already in payment, something like 70 billion lies in the hands of insurers, 400 billion in the hands of occupational pension plans, 190 billion in unfunded public employee pension plans, the state earnings related pension system, or the second state pension, over 100 billion, and the basic state pension system, 390 billion, a total of 1.2 trillion already in payment, and another 1.4 trillion coming up. That's a massive amount of exposure to this particular aggregate risk, and someone's either going to have to assume that risk or manage it in one way or another. So what are the possible responses? Those who carry the risk can assume it as a legitimate business risk, or they can try and reinsure it, or they can try and securitize it, or they can try and share it out amongst the existing policyholders in the form of, say, participating annuities with survival credits. Or, which is what we're interested in, considering whether the risk can be managed with mortality-linked securities. The possible stakeholders in this exercise are those that wish to hedge, general investors who might be seeking low beta securities for diversified portfolios, speculators who are essential for creating and providing liquidity to any financial market, arbitrageurs who might arbitrage between related instruments if there is a well-defined pricing relationship between those instruments, and naturally the government who is the insurer of last resort and is also interested in providing stability to the economy and to the marketplace as a whole. There have been a couple examples of instruments that have been offered to the markets. The Swiss Re mortality catastrophe bond in 2003, a short-term bond, three-year bond, reduces exposure to catastrophic mortality events in Swiss Re's own book. This was very successful. It was oversubscribed, and indeed a second tranche was issued to investors last year on less favourable terms than the first tranche. Then we had the European Investment Bank BNP bond offered to the markets in 2004, 25-year bond, long-term bond, based on the population mortality of 65-year-olds from England and Wales, and unfortunately insufficient investor interest, and it was withdrawn. But we can learn important lessons, we hope, from the experiences of these two instruments. We can think of, and in the paper we discuss, a whole range of new mortality-linked securities. Some of the ideas come from the existing financial markets. Some of them are specific to mortality products. Within the cash market, the spot market, we can think of various types of longevity bond, classical longevity bonds, or what we call originally survivor bonds. These are bonds without a fixed length of life. They have stochastic maturity, and the payments continue while a particular reference population is still alive. Geared longevity bonds to reduce the capital outlay, in which the actual payments lie within a particular range. Deferred longevity bonds that focus on the more distant cash flows or the more distant liabilities, which are riskier in terms of longevity risk. And possibly principal at risk bonds, where the principal is reduced if survivorship is above a threshold. This was the type of bond issued by Swiss Re and was a success. We can think of the derivatives market, mortality swaps. Classic example would be a fixed for floating swap based on a survivor index. This is flexible and tailor-made, and it was an example of the swap embedded in the EIB bond. We can think of futures markets, mortality futures markets, in which the underlying is either a cash market instrument like a bond or indeed an index. AFPEN, the Association of French Pension Funds, is considering launching an annuities futures market based on UK mortality rates. And as we all know, the UK sells more than half the world's life annuities at the present time. We can think of option products, survivor caps, survivor floors, and we can think of options on annuity futures. We looked at, in our paper, reasons why futures markets survive and why futures contracts fail, and here are some of the key underlying factors. Futures markets depend on having a liquid spot market, and there are very few examples of futures markets that have survived historically without having an underlying liquid spot market. One of the few examples are weather futures, in which there's naturally no underlying. The spot prices must be sufficiently volatile to create both hedging needs and speculative interest, and the underlying must be homogeneous or be able to be assigned to a well-defined grading system. The market for its success also requires active participation by both hedgers and speculators, and possibly arbitragers too. An extremely important feature that we have in our discussions come across is the nature of any mortality index upon which such an instrument would be based. And the choice of any reference population is critical, and that's because of the issue of basis risk. The difference between the realized mortality experience of the reference population and the hedging population of interest to a hedger. There's issues about the integrity of the index, its construction, and various moral hazard aspects. Swiss Re, for example, while wanting to hedge its own book, decided to use independent population mortality indices, but it chose the weights to be as close as possible to its own exposure. So the choice depends on whether we go for population tables or the specific populations that hedgers might wish to hedge, such as insurance companies. And in the UK, for example, these might be based on CMI tables, or indeed the hedger's own mortality experience. There's an issue of credit risk, since the payments go out for many, many years. And we've looked at the classic solutions to this: credit enhancement, credit derivatives, and possibly securitization via an SPV. We were particularly concerned about barriers to the development of this market. The EIB bond did not generate sufficient demand to be launched, and it's instructive to look at some of the reasons for this. There were design issues, pricing issues, and institutional issues. The design issues. The capital outlay on the bond was considered too high relative to the hedging capacity, and there was no capital left over for hedging other particular risks, such as inflation. There was concern that the basis risk might be too high, that there might be too wide a gap between the reference population and the own mortality experience of the hedger. The instrument was based on 65-year-olds, but pension funds and insurers have within their policyholders people of different ages, and there's basis risk as a result of the age factor. The instrument looked at male lives or hedged male lives, but there are females in the pensioner and annuitant population as well. There are issues related to pricing. Embodied in the price of the bond was a risk premium of 20 basis points. We had no idea, because this was the first type of bond, whether this was a fair calculation of this premium. There were demand versus supply issues. We might believe that the demand for these instruments are high, but unless the market believes that there will be an adequate and continuous supply of similar instruments into the future, why should anybody go into a bond that might be the only bond ever issued? There's therefore a need for more research and for more education on these issues. And there's also the question of how the basis risk will affect the issue price and the subsequent market price. Institutional issues. The issue size was considered to be too small to create a liquid market. Consultants were reluctant to recommend it to trustees. No one was willing to be the first to leap. And fund managers at the time did not have a mandate to manage longevity risk, so there was no particular need for fund managers to look to this bond. Of particular importance was, at the time, the inadequacy of reinsurance capacity. The EIB BMP could not find an EU or a UK reinsurer, and the Bermuda-based partner Re would not cover for more than the issue amount of 540 million. So those were the problems in terms of getting the spot market going. We looked at why futures and options markets have survived or failed. As I mentioned earlier, it seems critical that a liquid spot market is a prerequisite to active derivatives markets operating. The underlying mortality index must be regarded as fair and trustworthy. The underlying indices must be few in number and also appropriately graded. A small number of contracts helps to increase liquidity, but leads to greater basis risk. But basis risk can be reduced with suitably graded contracts. Conclusions. Mortality-linked securities are potentially very useful tools for managing longevity risk. We believe that once the teething problems are overcome, the way will be clear for markets in these securities to develop and mature. We would then be on the cusp of a completely new global financial market in mortality-linked securities. And these are the types of questions that we would like to raise with you today and to discuss with you today. What prospects for a market developing? How much appetite is there for hedging? Views on good and bad contract design? How big a problem is basis risk in reality? Experiences on security design? Views as an advisor, views as a hedger, from both the pension fund, life office, and reinsurer. So these are some suggestions, some questions that we would welcome contributions from today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, David. I'd now like to ask Colin Wilson to open the discussion.
Thank you, President. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to thank the authors for a very interesting paper. It's also timely, given recent market events, as they've already indicated. I certainly agree with the paper that everyone should welcome the successful development of this market. It would not only allow the efficient transfer of risk, but also make the whole concept of market-consistent reserving and pricing for annuity business that much more coherent. The paper discusses the structure of existing mortality-linked and longevity-linked securities and a wide variety of possible forms that future deals could take. Although the authors do not explicitly distinguish between shorter-term mortality-linked securities and longer-term longevity-linked securities, I believe it is worth doing so, as the markets seem to be developing at different rates. Catastrophe bonds, like the Swiss Re examples described in Section 4.2, are now an accepted alternative to reinsurance. And with Scottish Re launching a similar bond earlier this month, the market can be said to be relatively well established. Conversely, the failure of the proposed EIB longevity bond described in Section 4.3 shows that there is further to go here. The main focus of the paper is on what I have termed longevity-linked securities. The authors demonstrate that there is a wide array of possible instrument types, including bonds, swaps, futures, forwards, options, caps, floors, swaptions, etc. And they also discuss the choice of underlying for new derivative contracts and a number of practical implementation issues. I think perhaps most interestingly, they consider typical conditions that need to apply for derivative contracts to succeed and the extent to which these conditions are met by mortality derivatives. However, before discussing these issues, the paper discusses the possible motivation for the development of these markets. Section 2 lists a number of ways in which companies might respond to longevity risk. The authors then make the assumption in 2.2 that the main parties concerned will wish to hedge this risk. It seems to me that this is a major assumption, and I would like to see more discussion of it. After all, hedging in the form discussed in this paper doesn't eliminate any risks, it simply transfers them between market participants. So it seems natural to ask the question, which the authors touch on in section 3, as to who are the natural holders of longevity risk. Of course, insurers prefer less risk to more, but insurance shareholders should and will ask the questions, what price am I paid to bear this risk? What is the cost of removing the risk? And is my balance sheet a more natural place for the risk to reside than, say, a hedge fund? Remember that longevity risk is largely diversifiable, and so at least theoretically should not be expected to carry a large risk premium. Another possible outcome mentioned in Section 2 involves the pooling of longevity risk amongst annuitants or pensioners. As the authors point out, some insurance companies have already developed non-profit annuity products that do this, and of course with-profit annuities have always done so. It's also very much in tune with the Pensions Commission thinking on basing state pension age on current life expectancy and similar proposals in France. And it's not as if annuitants don't already accept significant levels of risk. Many choose to take a level annuity rather than an index-linked annuity. And even with an index-linked annuity, the annuitant must accept what is probably a significant basis risk between the RPI index on which annuity increases are based and the rate of price inflation for what they spend their money on. So perhaps we should think about financial risks arising from longevity in two parts. Those which already exist because corresponding promises have been made to individuals, and those where the option to leave the risks with the individuals concerned still exists. Of course, the development of an active market in longevity-linked securities would help in the pricing of alternative annuity products, as well as the management of existing longevity risks. The related questions of the choice of underlying mortality index and basis risk are discussed in the paper in a number of places, most notably in section 10. These are clearly very important issues, affecting on the one hand the likely saleability and liquidity of the security, and on the other the value of the security in enabling the issuer to hedge its risks. The focus at present seems to be on the first aspect of this, with standardisation of underlying seen as important in developing the market. Hence, for example, CSFB's launch last month of a longevity index for the US based on standardised measures of life expectancy of the general population, plus gender and age-specific sub-indices, specifically designed to help price and structure financial instruments related to longevity risk. In this context, it would be helpful to see some figures for the correlation between changes in life expectancy in the US and, for example, the UK. However, evidence from within the UK showing different patterns of mortality and patterns of mortality improvements between different socioeconomic groups suggests that basis risk is a real issue and not just an excuse for inaction. A further factor that may affect the development of this market is the attitude of the government. The paper discusses the possible role of government in section 3.5. Incidentally, I'm not convinced by the description of the UK government as insurer of last resort. After all, the government went out of its way not to stand behind the Pensions Protection Fund. But this doesn't affect the fact that the government has significant exposure to longevity risk, as well as, presumably, an interest in helping pension funds and insurance companies to manage their longevity risks. Section 8.2 reviews factors contributing to the success or failure of new futures contracts based on past experience. The most important criterion for success listed is the existence of a large liquid spot market in the underlying. This and the other factors given would seem to pose considerable barriers to the development of a mortality futures contract. However, this does not preclude the successful trading of over-the-counter forward contracts. Some encouragement can be found here if we extend the author's example of property futures in section 8.3, as after several attempts, there does finally appear to be an active market developing today in property forwards. Overall, the paper provides a useful codification of types of mortality derivatives and can only help the process of developing the market by providing a new focus. However, we should not underestimate the considerable practical barriers to implementation of longevity-linked securities. There has been significant effort from a number of investment banks over several years, but there's very little to show for that so far. Nevertheless, I agree with the authors that eventually capital markets will find a way to make this work, and some genuine opportunities for risk management in this area will emerge. I should like to thank the authors again for a very interesting paper.
Thank you, Colin. We'll now open the discussion to the floor. I would add at this stage that the authors have said they'd be very happy, more than happy, to take questions during the course of the evening from the floor and try and answer them. So we might have a slightly more informal meeting tonight. Please don't let the fact that the meeting is being recorded deter you from contributing. You will get the opportunity to see your comments before they get published and tidy them up if you want to, an opportunity that I always take myself. If for any reason time does not allow you to make your full comments, then these can be submitted as a written contribution for the journal after the meeting. We'll have some roving microphones available, so if you don't want to come up to the lectern, if you just want to ask a quick question through the roving mic, that will be fine. If anybody's still got their mobile telephone on, could they please turn it off because it interferes with our sound system? And it says here, it is not sufficient to mute the ringing tone. Your phone will still try to talk to its base, and this is picked up by our equipment. Could I ask all our contributors to state their name clearly before speaking so that we can get that in the record? Now, I've had five names of people who've indicated in advance they would like to contribute, So what I propose to do is to invite them in turn to speak to us, to make their contribution, and then I'll throw it open to everybody else. And as I said earlier, questions to the authors if you want, rather than a prepared speech. Could I then invite Chris O'Brien to come up?
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, insurance companies take on the risks that other people don't want. So many thanks to David, Andrew and Kevin for this paper on how insurance companies and also pension funds can manage the mortality risks that they have. I remember that when I worked for a life insurance company, attending a conference that covered both life and general insurance. It wasn't an actuarial conference, which perhaps says we tend to be a bit too compartmentalised. And I heard a paper on catastrophe bonds that were used by general reinsurers, and it's an exciting concept of capital markets being used to hedge insurance risks, and so it's good to see it now being applied to mortality risks. One of the first stages, though, in managing risk is risk identification, and we know that individual mortality risk is diversifiable, but it's clear that we haven't really given enough thought in the past to identifying the systematic mortality risks that can affect us. I would certainly like to think that pension funds give more thought to mortality hedging controls and securities. Firms, after all, firms often outsource the operations that are not their core skills so that they're not left bearing those risks. And I would suggest that it's pension funds that need to consider longevity risk in a similar way. Indeed, if we see a new development of arrangements to manage closed pension funds, I think that they would be reluctant in particular to be fully exposed to longevity risk and should be particularly interested in these securities. I also suspect that regulators will have a particular interest in it. The FSA has set stress tests for large with-profit life insurers that lead to a capital requirement depending upon market, credit and persistency risk. And if they set a stress test for non-profit life insurers, I would certainly think it was logical for there to be a mortality stress test. And designing this test needs, of course, considerable thought, recognising that lower mortality rates have different effects on assurances and annuities. But logically, the outcome is that the capital requirements for life insurers would be reduced if the insurer has appropriate mortality hedging in place to control those risks. However, regulators also need to ensure that they give appropriate credit for both reinsurance and mortality hedging securities as methods of risk control. And the same could follow for pension funds. And I would certainly expect the pension regulator and the pension protection fund to be interested to see which funds buy mortality risk protection. Indeed, I suspect that fund members might be more comfortable with the protection in place that that might give. I guess that the accounting standard setters would not be too far behind either. Should life insurers and pension funds with mortality-related liabilities value these at the price at which such liabilities can be transferred on the capital markets? There are pros and cons to this, and to some extent it depends upon how the market emerges. Of course, there are a number of examples in recent years where we have seen the investment choices and some of the management actions of insurers and pension funds being influenced by the regulators and the accounting standards, although I wouldn't wish to suggest that those influences have always been wrong. When it comes to mortality-linked securities, let us hope that the market can come to an early conclusion on what product designs are suitable. This involves overcoming quite a lot of obstacles and may well take some time, as indeed the market for hedging general insurance risks has shown. However, we should then see insurers and pension funds giving proper consideration as to whether to hedge or not, and disclosing to stakeholders the residual mortality risks that they are taking. Regulators may have a role in this by requiring disclosure of mortality risks, and that would be a stimulus to improving what may have been inadequate mortality risk identification in the past.
Paul Sweeting.
This is an interesting paper dealing with practical answers to a topical issue. I think it's important, though, not to spend too long thinking about bonds at the expense of some of the derivatives, such as swaps. Now, I know that the authors have also worked on several papers that consider the use of longevity or survivor swaps, but I think it is worth spending some time discussing them here in more detail this evening. The authors highlight the problems associated with the EIB-BMP bond and suggest solutions to many of these problems, but I think in a number of cases, a simpler solution is just to use a more suitable longevity instrument, and in many cases that's going to be a swap. Indeed, the authors point out some of the advantages of swaps over bonds in this context. However, they only allude to the key advantage I think that swaps have, which is the ability to separate the decision to reduce unrewarded risk from the decision on how to spend the risk budget. I think there's also a more pragmatic reason to consider the swap market in more detail. Innovative instruments, such as those relating to longevity, are always more likely to be used by larger institutions, at least initially, and such institutions are more likely to use and to be able to use over-the-counter instruments such as swaps. A good recent example is that of inflation swaps and the subsequent introduction of liability-driven investment funds. Swaps do provide, at least potentially, a more practical and flexible way for larger pension schemes to manage their mortality and longevity risks. And if swaps are ultimately traded in a standardized framework, then a liquid market might be a possibility. And a liquid survivor swap market would provide instruments that could be used to create bonds or funds that would allow smaller investors to hedge risk as they saw fit. So whilst longevity bonds offer an intuitively simple approach, I believe that at present their flaws are such that their practical use is limited to the extreme event versions, such as the Swiss Re catastrophe bond, and that survivor swaps offer a more practical and scalable way forward.
Peter Wright.
Thank you, Mr. President. I found this paper very thought-provoking. I might have enjoyed it even more if the theme of aggregate mortality rates introduced in paragraph 1.1 had been expanded upon. But perhaps discretion is the better part of valour in this particular area. I must admit that I don't share the author's bullish view of the prospects for longevity as opposed to mortality securities. In my conversations with investment banks concerning embedded value securitizations, I've gained the impression that they view anything associated with longevity risk as being akin to toxic waste. There are fashions in this business, and it's quite possible that the time will come for these securities, but I think we are some way off this at present. Section 3 gives possible interested parties in these securities. General investors probably already have as much, if not more, of this risk than they really want through investment in companies with large defined benefit pension schemes. As for the government, this section of the paper does refer to its liabilities under the old age pension and SERPs, but fails to refer to the vast liability for public sector pensions, where it's probably true to say it is genuinely the insurer of last resort. The principal issue I would like to raise today, however, is not one which concerns the main subject matter of this paper. Rather, the paper drew my attention to a long-standing practice in the insurance industry in a way which I had not seen quantified or analysed before, namely the practice of companies moving in and out of the annuity market. For genuine new business, companies clearly have the right to set whatever terms they like for annuities. However, if they make similar drastic changes to the rates offered on their vesting personal pension contracts and group money purchase plans, then I do wonder whether this is consistent with the concept of treating customers fairly. The existence of the open market option is some argument to support this practice within the concept of treating customers fairly, but the exercise of this option may not be practical in all circumstances, particularly where the accumulated fund is relatively small. The ability from AIDA to commute fund values of up to £15,000 could make the issue less of a problem, but with treating customers fairly so prominent at present with the thinking of the FSA, I did think that the matter should be aired today. Finally, in 8.4.4 Roman numerals 4, the authors point to an apparent steep drop in annuity rates in 2002, beyond what would be explained by interest rate movements alone. I do wonder whether, in addition to mortality expectations, this could have been influenced by a change around that time in the perception of the appropriate allowance to make in pricing for anticipated rates of return in excess of the risk-free rate. Now, that's all I wanted to say on the paper itself, but the President has given me license to refer to another event in this hall, forthcoming event. On the 10th of May this year is the 100th anniversary of the birth of Frank Reddington, who is arguably the most famous member of the Institute there's ever been. And we do propose to commemorate this occasion by having a couple of talks in this hall, starting at 5:30. The main talk will be given by Professor David Babel of the Wharton Business School, University of Pennsylvania, and he will be speaking on bringing the subject of asset liability matching and immunisation up to date for the 21st century. And Professor Babel will be preceded by Sir Brian Corby, a work colleague of Frank Reddington, who will be speaking on the subject of the business issues faced by Reddington during his professional life, and the resonance that some of those issues have with events in the UK insurance industry over recent years. So I do hope you'll put, obviously there's going to be much more publicity of this event as we get closer to it, but I do hope you'll put that in your diaries. Thank you very much.
Right, I now invite Ivor Kenner. While he's going to the microphone, I would mention that it was Ivor who raised at last year's AGM the suggestion that we should hold the event for, in honour of Frank Reddington. So your wishes have come to fruition, sir.
A lot of hard work has been put in on this paper. All the same, it amounts to little more than a discussion of how to arrange the lifeboats on the Titanic. Some of the lifeboats are hypothetical. Optimum arrangement of the lifeboats is desirable. This will ensure an orderly evacuation. It will not prevent the Titanic from hitting the iceberg. Why are pension schemes in crisis? Briefly, because of low real yields and improving longevity. It is elementary actuarial science that, as far as pensions are concerned, an increase in the force of interest counterbalances a decrease in the force of mortality. I have ploughed through hundreds of square feet of reports on increased longevity. Nowhere have I been able to discover what increase in yields would counterbalance the likely decrease in mortality rates. Accordingly, I have worked on the following assumptions. Males retiring at 65, current assumed expectation of life, 16 years, future likely expectation of life, 20 years, pensions linked to inflation, currently 3%, current interest rates and yields, 6%. My calculations show that an increase of 2% in interest rates would be required to offset the effect of improved mortality. The question is how to obtain the extra 2%. Official interest rates are political. Intense lobbying is going on all the time to keep interest rates down. Our manufacturing industry, we are told, will perish if the official rate of interest is increased. In fact, UK manufacturing may well perish, but not because of increases in the rate of interest. Funded pension schemes are already perishing. The actuarial profession needs to put the case for higher official interest rates. What is the case? Firstly, P. Dasgupta noted that if we had to choose a single ordinal measure of general well-being, life expectancy at birth would seem to be the best. Improved longevity is something of which the United Kingdom can be proud. Secondly, the Preston curve shows that life expectancy goes up as GDP per capita increases. GDP per capita goes up much more quickly than life expectancy. The increase in GDP per capita provides the wealth to pay for the improved longevity. Thirdly, part of the increase in GDP has to be channeled into extra money for pensions. As regards state benefits, this needs to be from increased taxes and national insurance contributions. As regards funded pensions, increases in interest rates are more appropriate. This year, as Peter has pointed out, we celebrate the centenary of the birth of Frank Reddington, an actuary who was not afraid to face the authorities up with the facts. I wonder if there's anyone like Reddington in the actuarial profession today. Thank you.
Richard Humble.
My name is Richard Humble. I'd like to begin by congratulating the authors on this very topical paper on this most important subject. I want to concentrate my remarks on the issues relating to bonds suitable for hedging pension longevity risk. in section 4.3.11, the authors discuss various reasons for the slow take-up of the EIB-BNP bond. One of the matters that they mention is that it was effectively restricted to male lives. I think this is the most important point, which needs further consideration. Not allowing for females was not merely a feature of the EIB bond. The female longevity trends have received much less attention in actuarial work generally. most noticeably the work on the cohort effect. And I think it's interesting and important to explore this. I suspect that part of the reason is that there simply is less insured data available to the CMI, and such data as there is for females tends to show some rather peculiar trends, as the most recent results indicated. But this is really not a good reason for the profession not trying to understand female longevity trends, given the huge potential importance of this subject. Now, if one moves away from insured data and looks at population data, the trends are rather more credible. And as the paper points out, there are other advantages in using population data as a basis for an index in a longevity bond. Now, the significant differences that are observed between insured pensioner experience and population experience are, in my view, to a very significant extent, a result of socioeconomic factors. And I think that as a first approximation, and I don't claim any more than that, it would be possible to allow for this by an addition to population increases in longevity. If one were to consider those issues together with the author's comments about the relative cost of the bond in terms of tying up capital in order to make payments in the short term, where the level of uncertainty was not particularly onerous, then maybe we could look at a bond which would be based on deferred annuities rather than immediate annuities, based on a weighted mix of male and female lives, based on population mortality as an index, possibly with an additional improvement factor for socioeconomic issues. And I think that would obviously depend on the particular block of pension business one was considering. I think if one was to adopt that sort of approach, one might have a longevity bond which came a lot closer to mirroring the reality of the profile of the insured and pension fund liabilities that it was designed to hedge. Thank you.
Right, I now throw the meeting open to everybody else. It would help me perhaps if I could have a show of hands of those people who'd like to contribute to the discussion. Right, I've got two down here and one at the back. Okay, Mark.
Good evening. My name is Martin White. I hope the discussion this evening will give enough weight to the difficulty of finding people who are prepared to accept other people's longevity risk against their own savings. If I consider my own position, I will need to live off my savings. At some stage, I may need to buy an annuity. If by that time, mortality had generally improved, I will get a lower annuity rate. But if I've already exposed part of my capital to other people's longevity, I will suffer a double whammy. When we talk about the capital markets or financial markets, we're really talking about the savings and investments of individuals. Just imagine the potential mis-selling scandal if bonds heavily exposed to improving mortality are marketed to people saving for their retirement. But isn't that the underlying purpose of most savings? So, which financial market participants will feel comfortable exposing their clients' savings to this risk? Longevity risk is a bit like the nastiest form of long tail or latent claims experienced by the non-life insurance industry. It has the ability to wipe out exposed risk capital many years after the contract is entered into, with no recourse to the policyholder. We cannot safely say that the insurance or reinsurance industry will step in. I like to think of such companies as stewards of the wealth of, once again, long-term savers, and they are more likely to want to offload this risk than accept more. I would not make the same comments about the risk of rising mortality, and the experience of Swiss Re in successfully issuing their mortality bond bears this out. Thank you.
Good evening, I'm Nigel Knowles from Credit Suisse, so I thought we ought to make some comments given that we had a little bit of free advertising earlier on, courtesy of Colin. I'd like to thank the authors for a very interesting paper. It's an issue that we've been grappling with and have taken a number of steps to try and source longevity protection from the capital markets. Possibly one of the most important things that maybe hasn't been brought out in as great detail in the paper as might have been. I like to think of it or refer to it as the Crayola School of Underwriting. Any of us can get a piece of paper and a crayon and draw a curve as to where we think future longevity is going to be. My guess is every bit as good as yours. And therein lies the fundamental problem. Whereas there are lots of people who have a view about which way interest rates are going to go, it's a lot harder to get enough people in a room together who actually can have a consensus about where that curve should be. Pick two people, the curves will be like here. If you find enough people, then hopefully we'll get some crossing. Suffice to say, we've been kissing an awful lot of frogs over the last 6 months looking for those places to cross. As far as the form of the contract is concerned, I agree quite strongly with one of the previous contributors' comments that separating the funding decision from the risk transfer decision is helpful. If I'm an insurance company, I like to buy credit or I like to buy other assets because I like the return on those assets. Embedding a hedging instrument in an asset which I wouldn't normally buy may not be very attractive to me. That's equally applicable if I'm a pension fund. I buy an asset because I like it, not because it happens to have some unusual feature. That's not to say that we shouldn't tag mortality and longevity risk transfer into assets, far from it. If that's the way to get capital into the market, good news. But the key thing is to make it an asset that somebody wants to buy in the first place. People don't buy gilts, then they're not going to buy a gilt even if we put a mortality coupon on it. If we make it an interesting credit-related payout or something, then they're more likely to want to buy it. The other comment, I guess, comes back to the nature of the contract. And I guess it's the same point as before in terms of finding it difficult to get two parties to agree in a room. A swap fundamentally requires two people to take two views, and they hopefully agree where the middle of the curve is. We've already said it's quite difficult at the moment to find people who have a common view as to where the risk, where the fair value, the best estimate lies. That naturally pushes us more towards the catastrophe or the option type of payout. The difficulty we have there, I guess, it comes back to who the sources of capital might be. Catastrophe bonds have been successful, mainly because you can buy a short-dated exposure to a risk. I'll have a view as to whether I think there's going to be an outbreak of avian flu or another typhoon or something, so I can get a handle on that and my bet, I'll see what happens over the course of 3 or 4 years. Longevity is necessarily a much longer-term bet. We need structures that people are wanting to tie into for 10, 15, 20 years potentially, because by the time we find out that we've got our latest set of mortality projections wrong, then hopefully a lot of us in this room will be beneficiaries of improving longevity rather than people rubbing our hands and worrying about it. Thank you.
Somebody right at the back who had their hand up.
My name is Andrew Wells. I'd like to join with other speakers in thanking the authors for an interesting and informative paper. I feel I know a lot more about the subject than I did a few weeks ago. I'd like to pick upon one aspect of the discussion. As the authors and other speakers have commented, many parties are exposed to longevity risk. This can include companies with defined benefit pension schemes and all the stakeholders in them. Long-term insurance companies and their stakeholders, whether they be shareholders, policyholders of a mutual company, and their representatives, the directors, and the government, with their exposure to the state pension, the SERPs or the state second pension, and as an insurer of last resort, if indeed that's what the government is. But I'd venture the comment that a lot of these stakeholders don't fully understand the longevity risks they are exposed to. I think this might be true even of some of those more directly connected with the risks, so pension fund trustees, directors of the sponsoring companies and of insurance companies, and those in decision-making positions in government. And I think the same is true to a much greater extent of the ordinary shareholders and stakeholders in such parties. I think that there could be a sort of virtuous circle here. The setting up of a proper market for suitable securities could greatly enhance the true understanding of the price, the value of the longevity risks that are being undergone, that are being taken on. And conversely, a greater understanding of these risks and their price or value could help in setting up a fuller market for these securities. Thank you.
Right. Any other contributions? Yes. One of our guests.
Denis Autier, I work for BNP Paribas, so we are at the origin of this attempt to move a little bit the market. Unfortunately, it has been a failure so far. But sometimes you have to try, and we believe that this market will progressively evolve, and this paper definitely will contribute to it. I just would like to give you some information about the background of the product, which maybe complete the paper. First, the positioning of this product is aiming to bring something more in the market. Today, if you want to manage longevity, if you are a pension fund, it's either a buyout, and it's only a very limited of pension funds which can have access to the buyout, or it's nothing, nothing in between. This product, the big advantage of this product is anybody can buy the product and offers a longevity protection. And that, we believe, was a massive advantage. The issue was that actually longevity is not a key priority for pension funds. They have much bigger problems to address before longevity. One is their asset liabilities management, exactly either their asset return or through ALM. Two, the deficit. And longevity comes probably number three. Why? Because longevity is a slow moving evolution. If you have markets like in 2000 going the wrong way, you're hit on the asset, you're hit on the liability, that is far more bigger issue for them. So longevity comes well after. We talk about the use, implementing this product as a derivative. Yeah. Actually, this product was also available in a derivative form. It's very, very easy from financial engineering point of view to reverse the structure of this product into a swap, very easy. I don't think it will make it easier for most pension funds for several reasons. One, pension funds are not used to manage their liabilities. They focus completely on assets, return on assets. And at the time when we launched the product, there were very, very few swaps which were implemented by pension funds. And they have already a big reason to enter into swaps, at least to manage their interest rate risk position. If they don't manage their interest rate risk position, they will not manage their longevity, because it starts from the same principle. The now talking about the longevity risk itself, is it worth taking in capital markets or for insurance companies? My view is it's a very, very expensive risk. And at the moment, there is probably not enough remuneration for transferring the risk. Today, if you look at who takes the longevity risk, insurance companies are taking this longevity risk. But are they taking it for the longevity risk? I'm not sure. I think they're taking it also to get the assets and consider that they will overperform a certain return of the assets to pay for the longevity risk. But so far, I don't know many companies offering longevity risk on its own, when actually if we are considering that managing longevity risk is really the business of an insurance company, they should be able to offer purely a protection on longevity. Actually, it's not the case. And it's the case of the business is insuring risk, but having the assets. And the bulk of the work is probably on the bulk of profitability is probably on the assets. This is already a sign. Cat risk, there was some comparison. For me, it's a completely different risk. We are very much at the tail of the distribution, when actually longevity, you are not really at the tail of the distribution. You are insuring a risk which is immediate. And cat risk offers a huge remuneration in comparison. Cat risk, today the price of the market is for 1% expected loss. You get paid six times this expected loss. You get getting paid 600 basis points for 1% expected loss. It's a massive remuneration, very, very interesting, and it's a big difference compared to longevity. Here we were talking of 20 basis points for the longevity risk, 20 basis points to get protected, even on an index basis, in the big scheme of things, is very cheap, in my opinion. So we believe, as a conclusion, we believe is that it's a longevity bond or either attempts to move the market in this direction. This will start to pay off because it's a massive structural risk that pension fund or the society in itself will have to carry on. But only part of this risk will probably be covered. I believe that in the long run, a risk at 40 years, 50 years is very, very difficult to manage. And it's probably like the Turner report recommended. Probably the structure of retirement, age of retirement has to change and make it a floating retirement age, evolving with the longevity. If the longevity improves, the retirement age will be later. And this will eliminate the risk, at least for the part which is active population. Thank you very much.
My name is Chris. Chris Lynn.
Chris Lewin. Ice cream sellers want sun, umbrella sellers want rain, hence you get a weather market. So I asked myself whether it might be possible to get a similar balance in the case of longevity. Who doesn't want excessive longevity? Well, obviously, the state in respect of state pensions and trustees in respect of occupational pensions, to name just two parties. Who does want more longevity? Well, some people may well want it for themselves. The state will want it for healthcare. I come back to that. And insurers who issue non-profit whole life policies would want it. Come back to healthcare. Much of the cost of healthcare is in the last 6 months of life. At the moment, that largely falls on the state, although to some extent individuals, wealthier individuals, might bear it through having to sell their house and things like that. Now, if longevity improves, the cost of health care for the population as a whole is deferred. That benefits the state and certainly offsets to a significant extent, in my view, the cost of the extra state pensions. Does it more than offset it? One would need to do sums to see. If it did more than offset it, then it would enable the state to meet an extra liability on a state-issued longevity bond without extra risk. It seems to me that further study of the total real costs to the community of long-term care in all its guises needs to be researched to see whether it is an effective counterweight to the extra cost of pensions for if longevity improves. Thank you.
Anybody want to ask the authors a question? They've volunteered to take questions from the floor. I can't believe everybody understood everything in the paper.
Could I ask a question of the audience then?
Yeah, please do.
One or two people have sort of suggested, is there really a need for this type of market? But certainly one of the reasons why we got involved in this research was that, at least speaking to some people, that there is a perceived need coming from pension funds, for example, that they would like to see some types of products of this type. So is there anybody out there who would like to make that, reinforce that particular view that's come into my mind?
Could I try and answer it, Andrew? Yeah. Because I think most people asked a question like that will say yes, but it comes down at the end of the day to what the price actually is. And until they see that, I don't think you can really believe the answer. There already is a market, in a sense, in the post-annuity market that's been referred to. Many pension funds don't like that price, so what they're really saying is they'd like something cheaper than that.
To make a contribution or ask a question. Okay, if not, then I will ask Malcolm Kemp if he'd like to close the discussion.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity of closing this discussion, and can I also thank the authors for a very interesting paper. We've had a number of issues raised by a number of participants. I think probably the most important theme that I noted coming through was whether there were really people who actually wanted to buy these things, and in particular the long-dated stuff of the EIB stroke BMP type issue. The Swiss Re product seems to have done quite well, the EIB clearly less successful, and there are a number of people who wanted to comment on that. One of the things I found very interesting, in fact, from where the presentation right at the beginning was how little of the risk is actually held by insurance companies. There's a table with insurance companies at the right at the top, and it had and they had very little exposure. And I would ask the authors if you can insert that into the material that we have actually presented in the when this paper is actually published, because I found that interesting. That suggests that not only do lots of the audience here have question marks about whether or not they want that sort of risk, but also even insurance companies are showing a degree of reluctance to hold longevity risk. One of the comments, I think Peter Wright came up with what I thought was quite interesting, which is that general investors have rather a lot of this risk already through the shareholdings they have in pension funds and the like, and one or two other people made that sort of comment. So I do think that there was some lack of enthusiasm for this developing too rapidly going forwards. A few other comments that were posed, clearly those, the last question that you asked of Colin Wilson, his response back that most people would like to be able to protect these risks, but they'd also want to know the price. However, I do think that it's it would be really great if this market did develop, and then it would be actually more possible to put a price on such instruments. The other sorts of themes that seem to be coming through, there was some discussion about whether some of these risks could actually be shared with the annuitants. There was talk about whether or not there could be some degree of hedging by the government with healthcare costs from Chris Lewin, and some of these things do already occur. There was a desire from Richard Humble that people focus not just on males but females as well, which I'm sure will go down well with at least, well, almost half the population, maybe more than half the population, I can't remember. There would be and there was also questions expressed as to how rapidly it would be possible to actually get people to agree on what they thought was the right sort of price. Nigel Moules making the comment that there's a tendency for a Crayola school of underwriting. I hope that that's not in practice true as far as most of our reinsurance companies are concerned. But I do think that there was quite a degree of scepticism as to whether there really would be the level of understanding to make this market develop rapidly. I just had a few comments of my own. I was interested by how the authors had used the term security in the title, when in fact they then went on to talk about derivatives. Typically, securities are used in the context of a tangible physical instrument like a bond or an equity. And the authors may have deliberately chosen to use a wider definition because the derivatives, or the D word, sometimes is a bit of a turnoff for investors. And I hope that's not going to be the attitude that will come through with these instruments. As was pointed out by our guest from BNP, these instruments can be converted into or out of funded physical forms relatively straightforwardly by capital market participants. Also, I'd just like to note that a decade or so ago, when I was an investment consultant, I tried to get Life to launch a futures contract on index-linked gilts. This, as you all know, was not very successful. Being charitable to myself, I don't think it was necessarily because my powers of persuasion are particularly poor. Maybe the timing wasn't right. And that was for a market that was, you know, pretty sizable even then, had become very widespread in terms of actuarial credibility at least, and even investors, albeit a bit tightly held. So do you think that the listed market, listed mortality derivatives, is going to be a tall order? And other people made that comment earlier as well, including Colin Wilson. Conversely, I would say that there's been a huge explosion in the use of credit derivatives, which are generally over the counter, over the last, say, 5 years. Now, this is only partly because there's a sort of natural role that credit derivatives play in the interbank market to enable one bank to pass on more credit exposure than they might otherwise have been able to lend out, because then the bank's credit officer can actually allow them to lend more money to their clients. An even bigger source of volume in that market recently has been things like the issuance of collateralized debt obligations and their purchase by insurance companies. And this has actually led to people or market participants moving away from the old idea of bundling together credit and interest rate views in the same instrument, i.e. a bond, and instead trading credit default swaps, the credit element, separately to interest rate swaps for the interest rate element. So it is possible, and the credit derivatives market does show that things can change, well, in the context of the actuarial profession, almost overnight. Although whether I would actually bet the bank on this happening in the case of mortality instruments is a bit of a different matter. So at least we can say on the basis of this paper that if such a quantum leap does occur, then we, the profession, will be positioned at the leading edge rather than behind the curve. And for this, I thank the authors once again. Thank you.
I now invite Andrew Cairns to respond to the discussion.
So thank you very much, and I'll certainly won't attempt to address all of the points that have been made in the discussion this evening, but I would like to say certainly that the discussion overall has been very interesting and very varied, so I think it's been a useful addition to the work that we put in. And just also a sort of general remark, which perhaps follows on from Malcolm's final comment, that for me, working on this in this particular general area, it has been a really fascinating area to work in, because it really pulls together a whole load of very diverse areas of expertise, from the traditional actuarial mortality, and on the other hand, you've got the financial markets, and you've got another hand, the financial mathematics, and things like that that go on all into this one big pot. And all of these sorts of things are very interesting to me, and it's nice to have a single project where these come together. Coming to some of the points that various speakers made. One or two speakers did talk about the need for this type of asset, and of course I passed that question back to the audience, and we're sort of getting varied responses. But I do think that if you take one step back and perhaps think about a more sort of pure financial world, if you try to just introduce or put into existence an asset, then the worst that can happen is that nobody invests in that asset. But on the other hand, the introduction of a new asset of the, for example, a longevity bond or some other asset of that type, it does allow for greater efficiency in the marketplace. So as I say, the worst that might happen is that nobody invests in it, but more likely, there may well be a price at which some people will go long in that particular asset, such as pension funds, while other investors will go short. And in aggregate, these individual groups will, the fact that they invest in those assets at that particular price should mean that somehow their general welfare, however you measure that, is improved. So thinking about Colin Wilson's comments, he made some remarks about the alternative annuity products, and I certainly think that that's a good approach as part of the overall package of how we might decide to, in the longer term, to address the overall problem of longevity risk. And to some extent, what we're doing in the paper is in fact saying, well, Yes, that's what we might do in the future, but we also have at the current time a big problem with longevity risk that's still held by the defined benefit pension plans and also, to a smaller extent, the annuity providers. There were one or two comments that Colin made and one of the later speakers about the different improvements in longevity amongst the different socioeconomic groups. And I think that that's a very important observation that while perhaps you might see that the within our typical pension fund, a large part of the liabilities will most likely be vested in people who are in the higher socioeconomic groups. And so just using a national index of mortality may be, may somehow underestimate the longevity risk there. So that if we're developing new mortality indices, then perhaps some way to try to separate out those different groups might be a very useful way forward. Chris O'Brien mentioned the regulators and the as a possible way of encouraging people to use or hitting people with a stick in order to get them to use these types of contracts. For example, if regulations change in a way that required pension funds or life insurers to use or to properly measure their longevity risks and more general mortality risks, that's one aspect of encouraging greater use of these types of product. But in a way, that's a slightly unsatisfactory way of getting people interested in this sort of market. What you really want is that people willingly go out to buy these types of products to manage their risks. And certainly, my view is that very much that this type of contract shouldn't be used in isolation, but it very much needs to be part of a much bigger package of risk management, be it within a pension fund or in a life insurance company or whatever. And indeed, one example of where this type of approach was taken was the Swiss Re catastrophe, mortality catastrophe bond, because one of the reasons why they introduced that contract was to demonstrate that they were doing good risk management. And then there is a beneficial effect that when they go to the capital markets to raise further capital, if that's what they want to do, then they get a better credit rating by virtue of the fact that they are using these types of contracts as part of a bigger package of risk management, good risk management. Paul Sweeting made some good comments about how the over-the-counter swaps market is really perhaps where things might go first of all, and perhaps I certainly agree with that. And the limited knowledge that I have in terms of what contracts have gone in the past already is that most of these are over-the-counter swap contracts. And there's certainly a lot that we can learn from that, but the other observation that was made later on by Denis Otier was that over-the-counter swaps are perhaps great for the big life insurers and pension funds, but when it comes to the smaller players in the market, that the swap contracts may be prohibitively expensive or just not possible to negotiate that sort of deal. And so the traded instruments are ones which might help to allow smaller pension funds and so on to themselves hedge this risk rather than just leaving it to the larger pension funds. Let's see, moving on. Richard Humble made another interesting suggestion about how a contracts might develop, and he was talking about variation on the longevity bond, which has a weighted mix and of ages and also by sex, in order to perhaps get a better match for pension funds. And I think that is certainly something that is worth following up, because one of the issues that we talk about is basis risk, in the paper. And if you think about the related example, coming back to the Swiss Re bond, the catastrophe bond, well, they designed that using, it was using national mortality indices, but they chose weights which allowed them to match as closely as possible their own exposure to catastrophic mortality risk. And so it seems equally plausible that a longevity bond or some or mortality swap perhaps it could be developed where there's some standard weightings which are attached to the different ages and different sexes. Martin Point made an important point that if you have these sorts of contracts, well, who are going to take the other side of the deal? And he said, well, it certainly shouldn't be pension savers. And I would very definitely agree with that. It's very important that individuals and their advisors, that they understand what risks they're taking. And so that, if anything, if you're looking at somebody who has a personal pensions contract, then they be opt as part of their portfolio, they may want to have a long position in a longevity bond rather than a short position in order to hedge that future risk of the when they come to retire, they have to buy an annuity, and by holding longevity bonds, that would partially hedge that particular the longevity risk that's inherent in that. So certainly, you're quite right that pension savers are not the sort of people who you should be advising to take that sort of position. And we don't, in the paper, give the answers to who, full answers as to who these counterparties might be. But certainly, if these sorts of contracts exist, then the individual investors have the chance to properly look at their risks and assess, well, do they want to go long or short in this particular type of asset? And I think that this is all part of having the existence of these assets is all part of having an efficient and transparent market. Whereas if you have the current situation where longevity risk is, as one or two people have pointed out, it's embedded within your individual investments in large companies that have big DB pension plans, the existence of these sorts of contracts does actually make things more transparent and easier for people to assess those risks and perhaps to reduce that particular risk if they want to. Nigel Knowles mentioned the sort of issue of having too many diverse projections, and in a way I see that as helpful to the development of a market, because if you have people with diverse projections of the market, then if you set a particular price, then some people are going to think this is a good deal to buy, to go long in that contract. Other people will think that that particular price makes it a good deal to go short. So if anything, I think a diversity of opinion is a good thing to some extent, because people will perceive that they can get a good risk premium out of that sort of investment. And I'm sure that that sort of diversity in opinion exists in other assets that organizations invest in. I think that's probably everything that I think I can make a coherent comment on, but certainly we look forward to reading the full transcript of the meeting and responding to any further points that we might have missed, and I'd certainly like to thank everybody again for the comments that they've made and for giving us the chance to discuss the paper this evening. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Andrew. I can just add a couple of comments of my own. I think I would observe that longevity is a much more complex subject than many people appreciate. As actuaries, we've been used to splitting populations into male and female and looking at different mortalities tables for those two groups. And more recently, smoker and non-smoker and and other breakdowns. But it seems clear from the work that we've been doing recently on investigating mortality of pensioners from large self-administered pension schemes that the socio-economic factors are going to have a major impact on future mortality. And this, to me, just underlines the problem of trying to develop suitable mortality indices that can underlie these longevity bonds. But this was a very timely paper. The existence of so many closed legacy final salary pension schemes will, I think, inevitably lead to innovative solutions. And there are already rumours around regarding possible new ventures in this area. So I would like, on behalf of you all, to thank the authors for this paper this evening and to join with those thanks to the opener and closer for their contribution. Could I ask you to join me in thanking all of them? And a big thank you to all of those who participated in this evening's discussion too. It would be helpful for those who are preparing the transcript of the discussion for the BAJ if anybody who had prepared notes could hand them to Pauline at the back there when you leave the meeting. I'd like to draw your attention to a bulletin board which has been set up on our website, which is available after each of these meetings for anyone wishing to comment on the paper or on the discussion. You can add your comments there. If you go to the heading forum at the top navigation bar as you enter the website, you will find it. And also, under our new CPD scheme, anybody wishing to claim CPD for attending this meeting, please sign the forms that are available in the room at the back. The next sessional meeting of the Institute of Actuaries will take place at 5 p.m. on Monday, 27th of March 2006, when a paper, A Change Agenda for Reserving, Report of the General Insurance Reserving Issues Task Force will be presented. I'd like to invite you all to join me in continuing the discussion over a glass of wine in the room at the back there, the council chamber. And to help with that, could I ask those, and I'm now looking right at the very back there, could I ask those seated in the council chamber if they could pick up their chairs and move them to the side of the room before everybody from here comes through. And I declare the meeting closed. Thank you.